Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
The Supertask edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week's web wisdom: food that changed us, 100 years of learning, limits of humanity, Supertask.
They have that meeting about what that weird lump is on your shoulder. After meat, one of the oldest cooked foods is bread. The process of combining flour and yeast may seem an unlikely discovery, but yeast actually grows naturally on cereal grain that is left out. So it was one of those happy accidents, like when someone dropped a pig in maple syrup and bacon pancakes were invented. The next major discovery was learning how to make food last longer. Because chasing mammoths and foraging for berries every day was tiring, and we suspected that TV would be invented soon, and we didn't want to be too busy chasing deer to be able to watch it. There are numerous ways to preserve food, and different climates gave rise to different techniques. The main aim of preservation is to kill microbes, and to prevent them from having the moisture they need to multiply. In hot climates, this can be done through drying, but it wasn't so easy for us damp people far from the equator. Those in more moderate climates turn to salting their food to preserve it instead. Osmosis is where the water inside a cell tries to reach the same concentration as the water outside the cell. So when you salt a meat, the moisture outside the cells has more salt than the moisture inside the cells, so the water is drawn out through the semi-permeable cell wall to try and balance it out. It's a bit like communism, but with less furry hats and more water. Other methods of preservation include smoking, sugaring, pickling, jellying, or just hiding your food somewhere where all the microbes can't find it. With the rise of electricity, the refrigerator became an everyday item for almost every household. The great thing about a fridge is that you get the benefit of longer lasting food without having to dramatically alter its flavour or texture, which most preservation techniques often do. It also enabled us to plan ahead, rather than having to constantly buy things we needed that day. Scottish physician William Cullen is considered the founding father of the fridge, since he gave the first recorded demonstration of artificial refrigeration back in 1756. The modern fridge works by pumping a coolant through a series of evaporator and condenser coils. Soon we will embrace the futuristic power of the smart fridge, where you will be able to text your device on your way home to see if you're out of milk. And it'll probably start hiding the cheese if it thinks you put a few pounds on. You're not the boss of me, fridge. One of the most reliable and long-lasting ways to preserve food is with canning, an invention that largely came about thanks to a game that the world likes to play, Cold War. Humans love war, we play it all the time. But it does make lunch rather complicated when you've covered all your veg in mustard gas and blown the legs off your chef. Frenchman Nicolas Appert won a substantial 12,000 franc prize for developing a way of sealing food in glass jars to help the troops in the Napoleonic Wars. Canning slowly developed from here, although the lead they used to solder the cans didn't do people much good, but it was about 100 years later when World War I started that it really took off. Unfortunately, there weren't enough tins to keep the Brits happy, and by 1917, British soldiers were issued with cigarettes and amphetamines to try to suppress their appetite. Both world wars had a major effect on food, especially in Britain, since we imported a large percentage of our produce. Rationing during World War II greatly reduced the availability of a lot of products, so much so that many children thought that fruits such as the banana were fairy tale inventions that didn't actually exist, since they had never actually seen one. Rationing went on until 1954 in the UK, and this is largely how the British ended up with such a poor culinary reputation around the world. The food was incredibly boring because there weren't many options, and it took us a long while to get out of that habit. Next up is not a technique, but the one man who has had the biggest influence on food all around the world is Auguste Escoffier. His book, Le Guide Culinaire, published in 1903, broke down the methods and techniques that make up all classical cookery. It formed the basis of classical chef training to this day. In 1890, Escoffier moved to London to take control of the kitchens at the Savoy Hotel. His system of organising a kitchen had a huge impact on their safety and on the consistency of the food. By breaking the cooking process into sections, each chef became part of a team who oversaw only a few small parts of the meal, enabling them to perfect it and repeat it. Before Escoffier, it had all been a bit hectic, and you'd be lucky to get a sandwich without someone chopping off a finger and getting hair in the butter. Dining at the Savoy became hugely popular and was what started London's restaurant culture, since before this, aristocratic families would have their very own chefs and eat in their own grand houses. But with the draw of great cooks, hotels began to get crowds of excited diners, and so the fine dining restaurants came after. Without Escoffier, the emperor of chefs, there'd be no Lancôme, no Gordon Ramsay, and no cheeky Nando's. When your tummy is rumbling and you scroll through all the things that you could possibly eat in your head, pizza, tacos, ramen, a kebab, a curry, sushi, you soon realise that the one thing that affects what we eat today more than anything else is immigration. There has certainly been a long history of ingredients being discovered and included in national cuisines. Just look at potatoes, sugar, rice. But it is the people who bring the rich history of the food and the new ways of preparing it that really increase a country's eating vocabulary. The Italians gave New York a lot of its famed cuisine, and try taking a Californian to a Mexican restaurant outside of their own state. You'll get more tutting than at a political debate. Curry is now one of Great Britain's leading national dishes, and the famous chicken tikka masala, one of Britain's most eaten dishes, was something invented here as part of the influence of immigrants. But it's not actually an Indian dish. So who knows what exciting new dishes will be invented in the next 10 years, thanks to the power of shared knowledge. Food preparation has been rather basic up until now. It's only in recent years that we've started experimenting with how technology can shape our food, from sous vide to spherification. Perhaps in the future, we'll be able to grow perfect steaks in jars and splice wheat DNA with a deep fat fryer so we can grow donuts in our own garden. Well, one can dream at least.
And from food to knowledge, here are 10 things that we didn't know 100 years ago. And surprisingly, apparently they did know about Trump. Weird. Well, that's if you believe me. Let's listen and let's learn.
Almost 500,000 of the people alive today were alive 100 years ago. And they've seen a lot. The roaring 20s, the swinging 60s, the lost decades, the wars, the art, the viral cat videos. Our understanding of the world has also changed a ton, just in their lifetimes. Around 100 years ago, humans didn't know much about genetics or quantum mechanics or why certain foods and fungi can keep us healthy. But 20th century scientists have made some important discoveries about humans, the Earth, and our entire universe. Here are just 10 of the things we didn't know a century ago. Number one, we didn't know that there are uncharged particles in atoms, which we call neutrons. By 1920, we knew that every atom had both negatively charged electrons and positively charged protons, which sit in the nucleus and make up most of its mass. But there was a problem. For example, it didn't make sense that a helium atom had only two protons because it was as heavy as four. And there wasn't any proof that some kind of neutral particle existed, one that added mass but not charge. At least, not until the 1930s. Researchers were experimenting with alpha particles, basically helium nuclei, and firing them at the element beryllium, which released a bunch of different particles. The physicist James Chadwick noticed that these mystery particles had no charge, and they were massive enough to bump out protons from other atoms. By 1932, he was convinced that these were different from electrons and protons, and were the particles the scientific world had been looking for, neutrons. Number two. We didn't know that DNA is in the shape of a double helix. By the early 1950s, researchers working on DNA were pretty sure it had a lot of genetic information and was passed down from parents to their children. But they couldn't really figure out how it worked without knowing its structure. Two scientists, named Rosalind Franklin and Maurice Wilkins, were experimenting with a process called X-ray diffraction, where they basically shined X-rays onto DNA. These X-rays bounced off the atoms and showed up as patterns on a sheet of film, which revealed a helical structure. In 1953, these images, along with lots of other research about the chemistry of DNA, ended up in the hands of James Watson and Francis Crick. They pieced it all together to make the double helix model. Knowing this structure inspired lots of new biology research to figure out how DNA's chemical code can make something as complicated as us. Number three, we didn't know that there's a vitamin C. And others. For a long time, we've known that eating or not eating certain foods can affect our health. Like, doctors in the mid-1700s realized that eating citrus fruits could prevent scurvy, a disease where people would develop ulcers, anemia, and exhaustion. But they didn't know what these fruits had in common. Vitamin C. Around a century ago, scientists began studying, isolating, and naming all of the vitamins we know today. For example, the biochemist Albert St. Jurgi spent the 1920s researching how our cells use food to make energy. And he came across a molecule in an adrenal gland, the hormone releasers right on top of our kidneys. It sparked his interest. It had six carbons and acted like a sugar and an acid, so we called it hexuronic acid. In the 1930s, he and other researchers ran some experiments on guinea pigs. Without this compound in their diet, these furry friends developed scurvy. Sound familiar? So they realized that hexuronic acid was, in fact, the vitamin C that scientists had been trying to isolate for years. Number four, we didn't know how to kill germs and fight off infections. The idea of killing harmful microbes had been around for a long time. Some ancient cultures treated infected wounds with chunks of moldy bread, but they didn't know why those treatments worked. The first medicine that could fight off microbial infections, called an antibiotic, was discovered by a scientist named Alexander Fleming in 1928. After coming back from vacation, Fleming was looking at petri dishes with bacteria that could cause nasty infections and sore throats in humans, and he noticed something strange. There was a little bit of mold at the edge of one dish, with no bacterial colonies growing nearby. Fleming figured out that this Penicillium notatum mold produced a compound, which he called penicillin, that could kill different kinds of harmful bacteria. For years, many researchers worked to purify penicillin from different molds, test it on humans, and eventually mass-produced the first antibiotic. This so-called wonder drug has saved lots of people from life-threatening infections. Number five, we didn't know that the universe was bigger than the Milky Way. At the start of the 20th century, astronomers knew the universe was filled with things like planets, stars, gases, and dust. But they didn't fully understand how big it was, or why certain clouds of gas and dust or nebulae were spiral-shaped and appeared to be so far away. This spiraled into the so-called Great Debate of Astronomy in the 1920s. Some astronomers thought everything in the universe was contained in the Milky Way galaxy, including these spiral nebulae, while others thought the universe was much bigger and that these nebulae could be entire galaxies of their own. To try and resolve this argument, Edwin Hubble used the largest telescope in the world at the time, the Hooker Telescope, to take pictures of the spiral-shaped Andromeda Nebula in 1924. He found stars upon stars, including some Cepheid variable stars, which vary in brightness and can be used to figure out how far away something is. By his calculations, Andromeda was hundreds of thousands of light years away, and almost certainly a galaxy. So our Milky Way is actually just one of many, many galaxies in the universe. Number six. We didn't know that hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe. Before 1925, we assumed that the rest of the universe was made of the same kinds of elements in the same proportions as the Earth. However, the astronomer Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin turned to the sun and observed something very different. Her PhD research was focused on understanding the light emitted and absorbed from stars, which can be used to figure out what elements they're made of. She realized that the sun was mostly made of hydrogen and helium, and it was different forms of these elements that caused the variations in light we observed. Her 1925 thesis concluded that hydrogen was about a million times more abundant in stars than we thought, and thus is the most abundant element in the universe. Number seven, we didn't know that the Earth's crust was made of tectonic plates. At the start of the 20th century, most geologists believed the Earth's crust was pretty much set in stone. They figured the Earth was once a hot molten blob, and the surface shrank and wrinkled as it cooled to form things like mountain ranges and oceans. Like, imagine a grape turning into a raisin. But in 1915, a scientist named Alfred Wegener came up with a theory of continental drift, that along long time ago, the continents all made up a single landmass called Pangaea and slowly shifted apart. Evidence started piling up, like we found similar fossils from the same time periods on completely different continents. But we still couldn't really explain how the continents moved. That came in the late 1960s, when geologists connected this theory to ideas about large underwater ridges which oozed molten rock and gradually pushed the existing seafloor away. With some more research, they concluded the Earth's crust was broken up into giant, slow-moving chunks that they called tectonic plates. Number eight. We didn't know that modern humans probably came from ancestors in Africa that migrated across the world. Throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, nobody really agreed where modern humans came from, and it's even still debated today. Some scientists believe that different races of modern humans evolved separately, but from a common ancestor that migrated across the world, while others think a population of modern humans started on one continent and eventually migrated around the world. Starting in the late 1980s, Charles Darwin's Out of Africa idea became one of the most widely accepted theories because researchers started looking for genetic evidence to trace human ancestries. A team of scientists compared human mitochondrial DNA, which is passed on from mothers to their children, and found it was very similar in humans all across the world. And more researchers keep finding evidence that modern humans are probably descended from one original group in Africa that grew different as they multiplied and migrated across the Earth over thousands of years. Number 9. We didn't know that CFCs destroy the Earth's ozone layer. The idea of air pollution, burning too many fossil fuels, and global warming have been around for a while, but we didn't realize how much some man-made compounds could affect our atmosphere. Chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, are organic chemicals made of some combination of carbon, hydrogen, chlorine, or fluorine. Throughout the 20th century, CFCs were being produced as coolants in refrigerators and air conditioners and in aerosol sprays. But some chemists realized that CFCs were floating up into the stratosphere and being broken apart by the strong UV light from the sun. The CFCs released chlorine that reacted with ozone molecules. They were slowly depleting the ozone layer around the Earth, which normally protects us from harmful UV radiation. At first, the researchers' ideas received a lot of criticism, but in 1975, they won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for their work. And by 1989, countries around the world began to sign an environmental treaty called the Montreal Protocol and promised to stop using CFCs in order to protect our planet. Number 10, we didn't know just how right Einstein was. Now, Einstein wasn't right about everything, but his general theory of relativity has really stood the test of time. The basic idea is that the universe is like a huge fabric of space and time, and heavy masses can bend and warp it. When it was first published 101 years ago, there wasn't much evidence to support his ideas. But over time, more and more tests kept proving Einstein right. For example, astronomers noticed that Mercury's orbit wasn't really acting the way they had predicted, but Einstein used his own equations to recalculate the orbit and was way more accurate. Then there's gravitational lensing, his prediction that light should be bent by the presence of heavy objects. And Einstein was right again. When we look into the night sky, we can see light getting bent around galaxies, making circular streaks in our telescopes. The cherry on top was the discovery of gravitational waves. Over 100 years ago, Einstein predicted that there should be small ripples in the fabric of space and time, like when a boat leaves ripples in a lake. And just a few months ago, the LIGO Scientific Collaboration observed them for the first time. These gravitational waves could allow scientists to peer farther out and further back in the universe and uncover even more of its secrets. We've made so many discoveries in the past century that have changed how we understand the world, the universe, and our place in it. And scientists are far from done exploring. So who knows what we might learn next?
And from expanding knowledge to the limits of the expansion of humanity, how far can we truly go?
Is there a border we will never cross? Are there places we will never reach, no matter how hard we try? Turns out, there are. Even with science fiction technology, we are trapped in our pocket of the universe. How can that be? And how far can we go? We live in a quiet arm of the Milky Way, a spiral galaxy of average size, about 100,000 light years across, consisting of billions of stars, gas clouds, dark matter, black holes, neutron stars, and planets, with a supermassive black hole in the galactic center. From afar, our galaxy seems dense, but in reality, it consists mostly of empty space. With our current technology, sending a human to the closest star would take thousands of years. So our galaxy is pretty big. The Milky Way is not alone, though. Along with the Andromeda Galaxy and more than 50 dwarf galaxies, it's part of the Local Group, a region of space about 10 million light years in diameter. It is one of hundreds of galaxy groups in the Lanier-Keir supercluster, which itself is only one of millions of superclusters that make up the observable universe. Now, let's assume for a moment that we have a glorious future. Humanity becomes a Type 3 civilization, does not get wiped out by aliens, and develops interstellar travel, based on our current understanding of physics. In this best-case scenario, how far could we possibly go? Well, the local group. It is the biggest structure that humanity will ever be a part of. While it is certainly huge, the local group accounts for only 0.00000000001% of the observable universe. Let this number sink in for a moment. We are limited to 0.01% of the observable universe. The simple fact that there is actually a limit for us and that there is so much universe that we will never be able to touch is kind of frightening. Why can't we go further? Well, it all has to do with the nature of nothing. Nothing, or empty space, isn't empty but has energy intrinsic to itself, so-called quantum fluctuations. On the smallest scale, there is constant action, particles and antiparticles appearing and annihilating themselves. You can imagine this quantum vacuum as a bubbling pot with denser and less dense regions. Now, let's go back 13.8 billion years when the fabric of space consisted of nothing at all. Right after the Big Bang, in an event known as cosmic inflation, the observable universe expanded from the size of a marble to trillions of kilometers in fractions of a second. This sudden stretching of the universe was so fast and extreme that all those quantum fluctuations were stretched as well, and subatomic distances became galactic distances, with dense and less dense regions. After inflation, gravity began to pull everything back together. At the largest scale, the expansion was too quick and powerful to overcome, but at smaller scales, gravity emerged victorious. So over time, the denser regions or pockets of the universe grew into groups of galaxies like the one we live in today. Only stuff inside our pocket, the local group, is bound to us gravitationally. But wait, what's the problem then? Why can't we travel from our pocket to the next one? Here, dark energy makes everything complicated. About 6 billion years ago, dark energy took over. It's basically an invisible force or effect that causes and speeds up the expansion of the universe. We don't know why or what dark energy is, but we could observe its effect clearly. In the early universe, there were larger cold spots around the local group that grew into large clusters with thousands of galaxies. We are surrounded by a lot of stuff. But none of those structures and galaxies outside of the local group are gravitationally bound to us. So the more the universe expands, the larger the distance between us and other gravitational pockets becomes. Over time, dark energy will push the rest of the universe away from us, causing all the other clusters, galaxies, and groups to eventually become unreachable. The next galaxy group is already millions of light years away, but all of them are moving away from us at speeds we can't ever hope to match. We could leave the local group and fly through intergalactic space into the darkness, but we would never arrive anywhere. While we will become more and more stranded, the local group will become more tightly bound and merge together to form one giant elliptical galaxy with the unoriginal name Milkdromeda in a few billion years. But it becomes even more depressing. At some point, the galaxies outside the local group will be so far away that they will be too faint to detect, and the few photons that do make it to us will be shifted to such long wavelengths that they'll be undetectable. Once this happens, no information outside of the local group will be able to reach us. The universe will recede from view. It will appear to be dark and empty in all directions forever. A being born in the far future in Milkdromeda will think there is nothing but its own galaxy in the entire universe. When they look far into empty space, they will only see more emptiness and darkness. They won't be able to see cosmic background radiation, and they won't be able to learn about the Big Bang. They will have no way of knowing what we know today, the nature of the expanding universe, when it began, and how it will end. They will think the universe is static and eternal. Milkdromeda will be an island in the darkness, slowly getting darker and darker. Still, with its trillion stars, the local group is certainly large enough for humanity. After all, we still haven't figured out how to leave our solar system, and we have billions of years to explore our galaxy. We have the incredible luck to exist at the perfect moment in time to see not only our future, but also our most distant past. As isolated and remote as the local group is, we can perceive the entire universe, grand and spectacular, as it is right now.
And on that note, we'll take a break. We'll be right back.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
Stressed lately? UBC Yoga Club is here to offer you a peace of mind. Come out to any of our 17 weekly classes running 7 days a week, ranging from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. We have a class to accommodate your needs and abilities. Check us out at ubcyogaclub.com.
Attention grad students, share your research, find out what's going on in other disciplines, approach your work from a new angle. Check out Fire Talks, the interdisciplinary discussion forum sponsored by the Research Commons at Kerner Library. Visit bit.ly/firetalk for more information.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM, the super show of knowledge and skepticism. And we're back. Okay, we all know what a task is, and I think if you use correctly the term super, what the hell is a super task? Well, let's listen, and maybe we'll learn something.
Vsauce, Michael here. Now, one of my favorite treats of the holiday season is Gabriel's cake. It's a super solid based on Gabriel's horn that you can make right at home, as long as your home is infinitely large. Okay, all right, now, the first thing you want to do is bake a cake. I prepared this cake earlier. It's a real beautiful cake. It's a little large, but I bet you I could eat that whole thing in a day if I tried. Am I right? Okay, now the second step is cut the cake in half. Notice that while I cut this cake in half, you don't add or create any new cake, but the surface area of the cake has increased. It used to be completely covered, and now we've got two regions on the inside that aren't covered. The next step is to cut this half, one of the halves, in half. Here we go. Again, the volume of cake on the table is the same as it was in the beginning, but the surface area is going up. As you may be able to guess, the next step is going to be to cut one of these quarters of the original cake in half. Oh, yeah, it's getting pretty thin, but all you have to do is keep this up, cutting halves in half and half and half and half forever, and once you've done that, well, you're almost there. When you finish cutting, stack the halves on top of one another in order, like this, to create a beautiful tiered dessert. Because you have an infinite number of thinner and thinner slices, when you're done stacking them, the cake's vertical height will be endless. Such a cake has an interesting mathematical property. Its volume, the amount of cake it contains, is clearly no different than the amount you started with, but its surface area is infinite. It's a cake you can eat, but not frost. You would need an infinite amount of frosting to cover the whole thing with a uniform coat. An object with finite volume, but infinite surface area doesn't need to be endlessly tall, by the way. There are bounded supersolids, like this cube with an infinite number of smaller and smaller circular holes. Of course, building these objects in the real world comes with some obvious difficulties. One is the fact that the amount of steps required to complete the construction of Gabriel's cake or any other supersolid is literally infinitely many. And infinity isn't a number that, you know, you eventually get to. It means unending. There will always be a next step, another piece to slice in half again. By definition, an infinite sequence of tasks has no last task. So you could never finish making a super solid. Or could you? Enter the super task. What if, instead of taking the same amount of time to complete each step, we accelerated as we worked and did each step in half the time as the last? For example, let's say you want to make Gabriel's cake in just 2 minutes. Well, that's easy. First, cut the original cake in half and then wait a minute before making the second cut. Wait half a minute before making the third, a quarter of a minute before the fourth, and so on. Always waiting for half of what's left to pass before cutting again. Since you can keep dividing in half forever, there will always be another step. Infinite actions within a finite amount of time is a super task. The strange thing, of course, is that while supertasking, no matter how many steps you've already completed, there will always be an infinite amount of steps ahead. But yet, when time's up, you will have finished all of them. What we've just described is similar to Zeno's famous paradox of the dichotomy, in which the Greek hero Achilles runs a short race that he can clearly finish. I mean, people finish races all the time, but how exactly it's finished is a mystery. Because first, Achilles must cover half of the race's distance, and then half of what's left, and half again, and again, and again, since there will always be another halfway point to reach. The number of subdivisions is infinite. There is no final destination, after which Achilles' next stop is the finish line. But yet, Achilles obviously can finish. He somehow reaches them all, despite the fact that during his journey, he always has an infinite number of steps left to reach. Think about it this way. What if at each halfway step along the way, Achilles is required to hold up a flag? At even steps, a blue flag, and at odd steps, a red flag. Blue, red, blue, red, blue, red, the flags will alternate faster and faster. But when Achilles finishes the race, which flag will he be holding up? To be holding up either flag would seem to suggest that a largest number not only exists, but is either even or odd. Now, to this, it is often suggested that the real problem here is that Achilles isn't actually doing infinitely many things. He's just taking a few strides or whatever. A true supertask requires doing infinitely many distinct actions. Fair enough. But even if Achilles ran the race in a staccato fashion, stopping at each halfway point for half as long as he waited at the last one, the scenario would still be sensical and logical and would complete in a finite amount of time. It has even been shown how a staccato runner could move to avoid discontinuous velocities and accelerations. The point is, fine, infinite distinct actions are at least logically possible to do in a finite amount of time, but only logically, only as a mathematical abstraction. Supertasks are obviously just products of our imagination. Because in the real world, there must be some smallest amount of space and or time that cannot be meaningfully divided in half again. Once you're within one of these distances of the finish line, the only possible next position you can have is the finish line. That certainly seems fair. After all, it's believed that in reality, there is a smallest meaningful distance, the Planck length. Any interactions between or observations of particles more accurate than this span make no sense within physics as we understand it today. And the time it would take to travel a Planck length at the fastest speed possible, the speed of light, is the Planck time. So these seem to be the briefest pieces of space and time any known force in the universe could act across, whether that force is gravity or a force from Achilles' leg muscles. But does that resolve the crisis?
Or is it just a way of avoiding the problem altogether by saying it doesn't matter because it won't be on the test? As John Ehrman has complained, it seems to me unattractive to make the truth of mathematical statements depend on the contingencies of space-time structure. Maybe Zeno's dichotomy tells us less about motion and time and space and truth than it does about our impressive abilities to confuse ourselves. And that's what makes supertasks important. They're a contact point, an uneasy handshake of sorts between the universe we live in and the brains inside us. Let's play around with some. They're not all the same. Some converge, like Zeno's dichotomy. Others converge, but in ways you may not expect, and still others refuse to cooperate in any way. They diverge.
A great example of a supertask whose behavior diverges is Thompson's lamp, a famous supertask devised by James F. Thompson. Imagine a lamp that can be turned on and off as quickly as you desire. What would happen if you turned such a lamp on and off Zenoianly? Well, let's find out. Just set a timer and turn the lamp on. Then wait 1 minute and turn it off. After half a minute, turn it back on, and then off again after a quarter of a minute, on again after an eighth of a minute, and so on, waiting half as long to flip the switch each time as you previously did. Now, as the number of switchings grows without bound, the total time elapsed approaches just 2 minutes. The lamp will be turned on and off an infinite number of times in just 2 minutes. So after 2 minutes, will the lamp be on or off? Well, by the definition of infinity, there is no last step. There is never a switching not followed by another. So the lamp can't be on because whenever it's turned on, it is immediately turned off in the next step. And it can't be off because whenever it's turned off, it's turned on right afterwards. What's the answer?
It's easy to say something about a supertask when its partial sums converge, but when they just oscillate back and forth forever, Zeno objects do this. Imagine building a meter-high cube. As with all supertasks, you construct at an accelerated pace. First, you put down a green half-meter-tall slab, then a quarter-meter-tall slab that's orange, then a green 8-meter slab, then an orange 16th-meter slab, and so on, until there are infinitely many layers of alternating color. Now, when you look at the cube from above, what color will you see? Orange? Green? Well, it can't be orange because every orange layer is covered by a green one, and it can't be green because every green layer is blocked by an orange one above it. What if we had a machine display each digit of pi in order at a super task pace? After its finite runtime, what would be on the screen? The last digit of pi? Well, that's impossible, right? But how could it be anything else? A super task allows us to exhaust an infinite sequence. Paul Bensaroff delivered what is often considered the best response to these confusions. Is Thompson's lamp on or off? Is the cube orange or green? The answer is, we don't know, because these questions are incomplete. Thompson's lamp could be on or off or broken. The cube could appear orange or green or something else. But the supertasks, as stated, don't let us figure out which. I may as well ask you if a lamp hidden in a locked room is on or off. It's definitely one or the other, but I haven't given you enough information to do anything but guess. Supertasks like these describe an endless sequence of tasks and then ask us about the end. But we can't determine an outcome because although there may be an end to their duration, there is no end, no final member of their actions. They must be reworded or coupled with extra assumptions in order to be solved. For example, if we assume that the switch used on Thompson's lamp can only be all the way on or all the way off, we can't determine where it is after the supertask. But if the switch is, say, a bouncing ball that completes the circuit, turning the lamp on each time it bounces on a metal plate, an outcome can be determined. If the physics here are ideal and the ball bounces half as high in half the time as it did on the previous bounce, its sequence of bounce heights will turn the lamp on and off an infinite number of times in a finite amount of time. Although this bouncing ball has no penultimate state, no second to last bounce, it does have an ultimate state, a final one, resting on the plate. The circuit will be complete and the lamp will be on. You can also describe a switch on Thompson's lamp that leaves it off. Sometimes the next state after infinitely many isn't paradoxical because of lack of information, but because of a surprising or non-intuitive discontinuity that occurs there. The Ross-Littlewood paradox is one of the greatest examples. Imagine a giant urn that can hold an unlimited number of balls. Now, imagine that you have an unlimited supply of balls, each with a unique natural number written on it. All natural numbers, in fact, since there's no end to how many balls you have. Now, working at an accelerated Zenoian pace, you move the balls to the urn 10 at a time, but in a weird way. At step 1, you place balls number 1 to 10 in the urn, but remove number 1. At step 2, a minute later, you place balls 11 to 20 in the urn and remove ball number 2. At step 3, you place balls 21 to 30 in the urn and remove ball 3, and so on. Upon the completion of the supertask, how many balls will be in the urn? At first, the answer seems obvious. At each step, you are adding 10 balls and subtracting 1, so a net of 9 balls is added each time. 9 plus 9 plus 9 plus 9 forever, the series grows without end. Infinite nines means infinite balls at the end. But here's the problem. At each step, the ball with that step's number written on it is removed. Ball 1 is removed at step 1. Ball 2 is removed at step 2. Ball 12 Google is removed at step 12 Google. Since there are an endless number of steps, for any ball number, there is a step number at which it is removed. So although the urn's ball population grows without bound during the task, after the super task, the number drops to 0. It gets weirder. Here's a second, seemingly identical method. Instead of beginning with balls 1 to 10 and then removing 1, begin with balls 1 to 9. Then write 0 after the 1 on ball 1. For step 2, add balls 11 to 19 and draw a 0 on ball 2, making it say 20. For every finite step, both methods result in identical urn contents. But after infinitely many steps, the first leaves us with no balls, and the second leaves us with infinitely many balls written on which are all the natural numbers, each followed by an infinite string of zeros. Both are discontinuous at infinity, but dang, in very different ways. The bigger question now becomes, so what? Who cares? You will never have an infinite number of balls, and you will never have a large enough urn to hold all of them. You will never build a lamp that can turn on and off arbitrarily fast. We cannot investigate time or space past a certain smallness, except when pretending. So what are supertasks but recreational fictions, entertaining riddles? We can ask more questions than we can answer. So what? Well, here's what. Neanderthals. Neanderthals and humans, us, Homo sapiens, lived together in Europe for at least 5,000 years. Neanderthals were strong and clever. They may have even intentionally buried their dead, but for hundreds of thousands of years, Neanderthals barely went anywhere. They pretty much just explored and spread until they reached water or some other obstacle, and then stopped. Homo sapiens, on the other hand, didn't do that. They did things that made no sense, crossing terrain and water without knowing what lay ahead. Svante Paabo has worked on the Neanderthal genome at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology, and he points out that technology alone didn't allow humans to go to Madagascar, to Australia. Neanderthals built boats too. Instead, he says, there's, quote, some madness there. How many people must have sailed out and vanished on the Pacific before you found Easter Island? I mean, it's ridiculous. And why do you do that? Is it for the glory? For immortality? For curiosity? And now we go to Mars. We never stop. It's ridiculous. Foolish? Maybe. But it was the Neanderthals who went extinct, not the humans. Maybe it's only a fool who will perilously journey out to what might not be there. And maybe it's only a fool who will ask about super tasks, about infinity. But if you want to solve problems, you don't just solve the ones that are there, you find more and make more and go after the impossible ones. Fostering a love and obsession with problems is how you solve problems. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry wasn't a mathematician, but his advice fits nicely here. If you want to build a ship, don't drum up people to collect wood and don't assign them tasks and work, but rather teach them to long for the endless immensity of the sea.
From tasking to vaping. In the light of all the dispensaries that have popped up around Vancouver, I thought I would share this clip about the science behind quitting smoking and the safety of e-cigarettes. Let's toke this one down.
I found that of almost all of the topics I write about over at my blog, the one that stirs up the most controversy, the one that generates me the most hate, the most emails, and the most tweets is e-cigarettes. Defenders of them are very passionate and surprisingly organized. Those that dislike them are no less dedicated. But let's get past the rhetoric. E-cigarettes are the topic of this week's healthcare triage. We all know what cigarettes are, right? Tobacco rolled into paper, lit on fire, and then inhaled, often through a filter. But all of that is a somewhat inefficient means of delivering nicotine to people. You inhale the drug, along with a ton of other crap in the smoke. E-cigarettes are different. Instead of using fire to burn tobacco, they vaporize liquid nicotine, which is then inhaled. You get almost the same hit of nicotine, but you get it through vapor instead of cigarette smoke. The e-cigarette market, only 7 years old now in the US, is about $1 billion a year now. In 2011, more than 20% of Americans who smoke had tried e-cigarettes. That means that more than 5% of all adults in the country had tried them. Kids too. Almost 7% of children in grades 6 to 12 tried e-cigarettes in 2012. Those who support them like them because they believe they're safer. They also think that they can be a means to help others quit smoking cigarettes. And if they're safer, that would be a good thing, right? But are those beliefs true? There's not as many studies on this topic as I'd like. A lot of them are flawed, and they often conflict with each other. For instance, a randomized controlled trial published last year in The Lancet compared putting people on e-cigarettes, nicotine patches, or placebo to quit smoking. At 6 months, 7.3% of those on e-cigarettes had quit, versus 5.8% with patches and 4.1% with placebo. But so many fewer people had quit than the researchers had anticipated that the difference seen wasn't statistically significant. But let's not cherry pick. The American Heart Association published a systematic review of e-cigarette studies earlier this year. Let's dig into what they found. To the research. One study found that the aerosols from 12 different brands of e-cigarettes contained fewer toxins than cigarette smoke in general, although they varied a lot. Other studies went further. Some looked at whether the nicotine fluid could be cytotoxic or harmful to cells. Interestingly, it seemed that most of the cytotoxic effects were related more to additives to the liquid, like flavoring, than to the nicotine itself. Studies of secondhand smoke with e-cigarettes were similar. Yes, you get nicotine in the air, and yes, you can detect particulate matter. People who smoke e-cigarettes are not exhaling water vapor, as many ads would like you to believe. But at this point, all we have are lab studies. Those show that secondhand exposure to e-cigarettes probably means less exposure to nicotine than conventional cigarettes. but it's not as much of a difference for particulate matter. There's no carbon monoxide, though, which is good. But let's get to health. Some people will point to cigarettes and say they can cause fires or explosions, and e-cigarettes can cause those too. You may have seen a video on the internet. They can also cause throat or mouth irritation, nausea, vomiting, coughing, all of those things too. Small studies show that there can be short-term pulmonary function changes after e-cigarette use, but these may be less severe than with tobacco cigarette use. Some studies show no change at all, but many of those are promoted by the industry or advocacy groups, and they're particularly flawed. The bottom line is that there's minimal evidence that they may be safer than tobacco cigarettes, but that doesn't mean that they have no negative effects at all. There's also pretty much no evidence at all to tell us about long-term effects. And do they help people to quit smoking? There are 5 population-based studies, 4 longitudinal, 1 cross-sectional. Combining them in a meta-analysis led to a pooled odds ratio of 0.6, meaning that e-cigarette use was associated with a lower quit rate than not using them. That's not good. But it's important to recognize that these types of studies aren't randomized, and they didn't control for nicotine dependence. In other words, it could be that the most addicted people were the ones trying e-cigarettes, and it's not the device's fault that they couldn't quit. So let's look at clinical trials, and there are 4 of them, including the Lancet one I already mentioned. 3 of the others didn't have a control group that didn't use e-cigarettes. None added in behavioral support or other components that usually accompany smoking cessation interventions. This means we can't have a ton of confidence in them. And the better trials didn't find any effects of e-cigarette use that were better than what we've seen in other smoking cessation interventions. In other words, there's no real evidence that they're better than nicotine replacement therapy or behavioral interventions. Harm reduction is different. If e-cigarettes can get people to smoke fewer tobacco cigarettes, then that might result in an improvement in health. There is some evidence that e-cigarettes may lead to people smoking less, even if they don't quit. But we need more studies of good quality to see if this is really the case. At this point, the United States, specifically the FDA, doesn't regulate e-cigarettes at all. Some states do, but not the federal government. New rules have been proposed, though, to change that. If they go into effect, selling e-cigarettes to minors would be illegal, health warnings would be added, and selling them in vending machines would now be prohibited. Companies would be forced to detail their ingredients, allow the FDA to review their marketing plans, and they'd get to approve any claims about the benefits they might have. Online sales would still be legal, and they'd still be able to advertise on radio or TV, which tobacco can't do. Those rules were proposed in April. There's been no movement since. In the EU, on the other hand, e-cigarettes with nicotine concentrations up to that of a pack of cigarettes are regulated just like tobacco. If they have more nicotine than that, they're regulated like medical devices. But as of March, it appears that the regulations might get even tighter. In the UK, things are a bit more permissive. E-cigarettes aren't covered by smoking bans, but legislation may be coming to bar their sale to minors. So let's review. There's a reasonable case to be made that if all tobacco smokers converted to e-cigarette use, there would likely be an overall health benefit. But the prevailing evidence shows that introducing e-cigarettes may lead to more dual smoking than quitting. And it may be getting more new people to start smoking, which would be bad. It's not clear. The stuff coming out of e-cigarettes is probably not as bad as tobacco smoke. But it's not harmless water vapor either. And if they were marketed as quit aids and sold as such, I think fewer people would be concerned. But they're often sold as a healthy way to get the sweet, sweet benefit of nicotine. That's not too far off from the ways that cigarettes used to be sold. That makes a lot of people uncomfortable, and it's easy to understand why.
And lastly, an update about vaping. What are we going to do about the kids? Let's listen and find out what the science says.
We've covered e-cigarettes before here on Healthcare Triage, but there's new evidence and new policies. You deserve an update. That's the topic of this week's Healthcare Triage. Long ago, Malcolm Russell wrote, and I'm quoting, "People smoke for the nicotine, but they die from the tar." He was referencing the fact that people get hooked on cigarettes, and enjoy them for that matter, because of the nicotine buzz that accompanies their use. The nicotine doesn't give them cancer and lung disease, though. It's the tar and other stuff in traditional cigarettes that carries the harm. Electronic cigarettes, or e-cigarettes, carry the potential promise of delivering the nicotine many seem to want without the dangerous additives that come with smoke. The use of e-cigarettes by youth has increased dramatically in recent years. In 2011, about 1.5% of high school students reported using them in the last month. In 2014, more than 12% of students did.
By 2014, this means that nearly 2.5 million middle and high school students in the U.S. had used them in the past month. This is concerning because nicotine is not considered safe for children and adolescents. Poisoning is possible. It's thought that nicotine interferes with brain development. Most concerning, it's believed that becoming addicted to nicotine in any form makes smoking more likely later in life. Moreover, it's not settled that e-cigarettes are completely safe. Enough research exists about e-cigarettes to have warranted a number of systematic reviews and meta-analyses. E-cigarettes are perceived to be less harmful than conventional cigarettes, and they are thought to be useful quit aids. Those perceptions, however, are not always fully grounded in evidence. A 2014 study in the journal Circulation analyzed the data from a number of angles. For instance, they found that the aerosol from e-cigarettes was significantly lower in toxicants than conventional cigarettes, although toxicants could still be detected. Those exposed secondhand were also at much lower risk from e-cigarettes than traditional ones, though some risk might still be there. In other words, we shouldn't believe that electronic cigarettes result in the inhalation of harmless water vapor, but they're likely safer than conventional cigarettes. Another review published later that year came to somewhat similar conclusions. They noticed that at least a third of the articles had authors with conflicts of interest. They reported that studies found concerning compounds in the aerosol, especially in the flavorings and propylene glycol, which aren't a part of conventional cigarettes. The authors concluded that e-cigarettes can't be deemed safe even if they are much less harmful than conventional cigarettes. We conducted our own mini review on healthcare triage a couple years ago and came to the same conclusion. But many public health officials believe that cigarettes are one of the most significant public health threats in existence. Electronic cigarettes don't appear to be in the same league. Some have argued that e-cigarettes can help people to quit smoking, much like nicotine patches or gum do. A 2015 study in PLOS-1 reviewed the evidence. Among 1,242 smokers, 18% reported quitting conventional cigarettes for at least 6 months, which was significantly better than those using placebos. E-cigarette use was also associated with a reduction in the number of cigarettes smoked per day. Only two studies were randomized controlled trials, however, and they were of mixed quality. Most important, these studies really didn't compare the usefulness of e-cigarettes for quitting against other quit measures, like medications or nicotine replacement therapy. It's possible that those are more powerful. Some argue that the use of e-cigarettes may be a gateway to later conventional cigarette use. A meta-analysis from early this year examined how people used both types of cigarettes. They found that current smokers were significantly more likely to use e-cigarettes and conventional cigarettes together. This was even truer in adolescents. In fact, the paper said, and I'm quoting, "The use of e-cigarettes does not discourage and may encourage conventional cigarette use." In other countries, such as the UK, they're taking the opposite approach. They're actively encouraging smokers to switch to e-cigarettes. I admit to being conflicted here. Of course, I'd rather no adolescents use either conventional or e-cigarettes, but I'm somewhat swayed by the arguments of those who advocate for harm reduction. Years ago, pediatricians used to advocate only for smoking cessation in parents because it carried a health risk for their children. Then some enterprising researchers showed that if smoking parents would just agree to smoke at least 3 meters away from their infant, it could reduce hospitalization of infants in their first 18 months of life significantly. Now pediatricians still advocate for quitting, but they also talk about smoking outside, away from babies. We don't want to make the perfect the enemy of the good. And of course, most pediatricians, including myself, would advocate for adolescents to use condoms if they have sex rather than preach abstinence only. We're capable of discussing harm reduction. One of the questions that few want to consider, however, is whether we'd rather kids smoke conventional cigarettes or e-cigarettes. Neither would be preferable. But a recent study in the Journal of Health Economics forces us to answer this question. The results showed that in states that banned e-cigarette sales to minors, there was a significant increase of almost 1 percentage point in conventional cigarette smoking. This is disturbing. Cigarette sales have been dropping throughout the country, but in the states that implemented bans on e-cigarette sales to minors, the decrease in conventional cigarette use slowed by about 70%. Moreover, it's still easy to get your hands on e-cigarettes if you want them. In 2013, North Carolina passed an e-cigarette age verification law. In 2014, researchers in that state supervised 14 to 17-year-olds purchasing e-cigarettes on 98 of the 103 most popular online internet vendors. The kids were able to get successful deliveries with no age checks from 75% of them. But that's because some of the websites didn't function. Of those vendors with functioning websites, kids were able to purchase e-cigarettes about 94% of the time. Our overall goal should be to get kids and adolescents to quit all types of smoking, period. Short of that, we should aim to improve the health of as many children as possible. Banning sales of e-cigarettes to minors may achieve that goal, but it's also possible it may not. It may also backfire. Further studies and a careful eye on nicotine use in all its forms are warranted.
And that's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.